What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot, dunk it! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
And get into the all-new OTV Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No,
videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do, get a slap?
Plus, exclusive content on the OTV Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTV Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So I have to say, really excited to chat to our next guest about his incredibly interesting career. He made his debut for Bristol Rovers age 17. He had a long playing career, largely in the old third and second divisions, finished up at Bournemouth in 1992. His first managerial gig was at Bournemouth, and then there were four good years at Gillingham, and really his second stint at Stoke was incredible, and it's how we all know him, I suppose, in the main. We're talking 7 years, 06 to 2013. Took them from Championship to Premier League mainstays, reached an FA Cup final, made the Europa League last 32, played at the Mestalla against Valencia there. Subsequently managed Crystal Palace, kept them up, Premier League manager of the season in 2014, thank you very much. And more recently, short spell at Sheffield Wednesday, which ended in December. I am, of course, talking about Tony Pulis. Tony, you're very welcome. Great to have you on.
Thank you, Joe.
I know you're not a tech madman and not a big man on social media, so you've sorted out Zoom or Skype or whatever you're on there anyway.
No, Deb's just done that for me.
Okay.
We wouldn't be talking otherwise, Joe.
Listen, loads to talk to you about. I want to kick things off with you in action, if I can. I found a clip. I was doing some research. So this will bring you back. Now, if there's any kids listening to the radio or sensitive ears, then just turn off for the next 2 minutes and then come back to us. There won't be any other bad language, but I thought I'd kick us off with Tony Pulis in action. This is Gillingham 1998 against Wrexham. You're going to hear some pre-match talk and then a bit of halftime advice as well from
1998.
What age were you then?
I don't know. Too far back.
Right. Well, you'd stop playing in 92.
Years back, Joe.
Yeah. So here he is. This is Gillingham getting ready to go out and play Wrexham. And here's Tony Pulis in action.
Body, a good start. First header, first tackle, first pass. Make it a fucking good one, lads. And then you start yourself off then. And your fucking first tackle. Let's not fucking forget that. Fucking look forward to it. Fucking get out there, fucking roll your sleeves up and start fucking working. Right from the first fucking whistle. Any fucking tackles, blue shirts. And then when we get it, fucking pass it. Don't pass back, don't pass square when you can fucking go on and do something with it. Gals, any space, run it in. Run it in, S. Don't get turning out, run it in. Run it into space. Nicky, same with you, mate. If you get past them, Nick, run it all the way. But get all of it. More than fucking two touches for a Steve. More than two touches.
Come on, as soon as we lose it, shape. S, give them a shout all the time.
Aiden, as soon as we lose it, shape. Shape all the time. Fucking shape all the time. They're going to score against us if they're going to do anything against us, lads. Let's fucking make them work for it. It's got to be a fucking good goal if they score it. Not one that we give them. Make them play fucking back. Make them play fucking square. Get your shape all the time, then.
Fucking off it in wide positions at times. We're just fucking off it a little bit. Gals, the eight's fucking taking the piss at times, mate.
I'm going to have to
fullback
though.
Hey?
At least
they stay. Yeah, well, we shuffle across then. No problem. So where's Stevie Butler? Steve, you pick the four, the 11 who's sitting out. Yeah. You pick him out and we shuffle across quicker. Right? As soon as it happens, where's Smudger? You're going to pick fucking Aid up. Because what's happening is, he's going out to the fullback. and the eight fucking tuck it in. But the last fucking couple of minutes, there's a throw-in, and you're a fucking blame as well as that. And you fucking, he's not marking no one. They're throwing it over his head into the lad's fucking feet. Get the there, so he can't fucking throw it then. And that's what we've been like, we've been loose. We're fucking loose, little parts are loose. S, Smudge, fucking magnificent in there. Keep it fucking going, well done, lad. But you've got to work the full, the right back is getting out all the time. And like the fucking two, one of you has got to get out to him. Otherwise he's their spare man all the fucking time. He's the fucking spare man all the time. But it's there if you want it. You've got to keep your shape and keep fucking tight. Keep your shape and don't take fucking chances at the back because they're nice and bright.
Oh, Tony, now we're talking, huh?
I deny everything that's just been played.
Oh dear. How different was Tony Pulis in 1998 in the dressing room like that versus say 2013, 2014?
Oh, completely. The you know, the world's spun round, the world's changed. I think then, you know, men were men, and there was an acceptability, I think, as a player, as a coach and as a manager, that you know, you could take a little bit of stick, you could take responsibility, and you could take the fact that people would call you out, and that was all part and parcel of early management, really. But it changes, you know, that society changes, and if you don't change with it, Joe, you know, then you don't last, you know, as long as maybe you could last.
So the voice mightn't have been as loud, the language might have been a bit different, more one-on-one stuff. What would you have been like in, say, 13, 14?
No, I'd still, a lot of the things that I'm saying there, still a lot of the things, you know, but if we could play forward. I was always an advocate of, you know, I was brought up at a young age, and it was always implanted, you know, being a more of a defensive player, older midfield player. That the best players on the pitch were the forwards and the wide players. And the basics when I was at Bristol was to get the ball to them as quickly as you possibly could and allow them to play. You know, they were, you know, the cream on the cake. And like I say, the more you could get the ball to them, the more you could do it with them being in the final third, you know, the more goals you'd score, the more opportunities you create, and more chances you had of winning football matches. So, you know, it was... I apologise for the language.
Not at all.
My children don't hear me saying that. but you know that you know, like I say, that I think that was accepted then very much.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be today.
Interesting. Look, stop with the apologies. We all use that kind of language. I mean, that's the way it was done. I thought it was very interesting at halftime. Halftime chat, it wasn't simply a case of you're not trying, I need more effort. It was very specific tactical advice. You know, their right back is free. You have to tuck in, you have to get out and stop him. There was some very definite information there. It wasn't just blood and thunder either. So obviously you saw the game very well at that age. And you worked very hard as a player even ahead of time on your coaching badges and got them young, and were going down to Lillishall and watching the likes of Bobby Robson or Terry Venables or foreign coaches putting on, you know, week-long seminars. So you knew pretty early on coaching could well be for me. I want to be in this game.
Joe, I'd left South Wales. I left a family of eight living down at Docks in South Wales, and I promised myself, you know, the opportunity of playing professional football would be a once-in-a-lifetime chance. And I promised myself I'd give it everything. And I'd do everything I could not to go back to South Wales, not in a bad way, but just to prove that, you know, or to achieve what was my dream. And my dream was always to be a professional footballer, to be involved in football. And I was very, very fortunate to go to a very, very good club, Bristol Rovers, for young players. You know, we had some magnificent people there who set standards. The standards they set were fantastic. They were great mentors. You know, the old Bob Campbell, Bill Dodging, you know, Don Makeson was my first manager, you know, Colin Dobson, I'd go through them, Gordon Bennett, Joe Davis. And there was great senior pros there as well, some fantastic senior professionals who helped you along the way. And like I say, it was a good club to go to. The reason really that I got involved in coaching so early was that at 21, I think, of 2021. First game of the season, we played in what is now the Championship at Cambridge. And I broke, I bust one of my main ligaments in my leg, and it snapped at the bottom in my ankle. I had an operation on my ankle. I was out for almost a year. Well, it was a season, full season. And during that time, you know, I was encouraged by the football club. This is how good the football club were to young people and young players. They encouraged me to take my coaching badges. They encouraged me to have another life if, you know, God forgive the, you know, the injury would curtail my playing career. And it just set me off, Joe. It just, you know, it just made me, you know, Dave Burnside was the, you know, the county coach for Gloucester, who was a wonderful man. And Dave helped me in loads of ways to take my prelim, my intermediate badge. And then I went on and took my full badge and passed all of them by the time I was 21 years of age.
Wow.
And that gave me the opportunity, Joe, then, as you've said, to go to Lillishaw as a young player at times, you know, being around the top coaches in the country, some top coaches in the world who came and put sessions on. But Lillishaw, the week at Lillishaw was absolutely, well, every year, you know, I put my name down to it before the season started. It was so interesting, and a great place to learn. And you know, you listen to, you know, you're lucky enough to be in company of, you know, top people who, you know, you talk about listening and learning and all the stuff that, you know, that you heard me talking about. It would have been gained over a period of time. And you know, one of the great things I learned from a very, very early age was to understand what you had in respect of quality, and getting the best out of that, whichever way, shape or form. If you don't win football matches, you don't stay in football very long. And what you have to do, and what I was taught very, very early, was to assess the quality that you had and use that to the best of their ability to get results that you need.
Yes.
And I've always done that. I've never ever moved away from that. I've always looked and tried to find a way of winning with the teams I've been with.
You talked there about your chance to go off and be a professional footballer almost as the winning lottery ticket. This is your chance to really make a brilliant life for yourself. Your upbringing, you mentioned in Newport, South Wales, this is real kind of mining town, steel industry. I think your father was involved in the steel industry.
Yes.
I was reading your upbringing, what, 3-bed terrace, 6 kids, 2 parents, 8 in the house. That's crammed in.
Joe, listen, we had nothing, but we had everything. I wouldn't change my upbringing for anything. I was brought up in a very, very, down the docks, you know, with the steelworks, we had the docks, we had the railway tracks running through the area that we lived in, bringing the coal down from the valleys to the docks and to the steelworks. But it was a wonderful place, Joe, to live. You know, everybody was together. It was such a close-knit community. And I learned and trusted, people, or learned how to trust people, because those people would look after you. If Mum never had, you know, we were a big family, but we weren't the only big family in town. There was you go down most of the streets down Pill, and you'd have, you know, 8, 9 children. It was that period. You know, there's a lot of immigration there. Obviously, my grandfather, second generation immigrant. You know, there was loads of Irish people there. There was loads of Italians. West Indians came late on in the 60s. So it was, you know, there was a mix of everything down there, Joe. But the community was absolutely fabulous. And if you were struggling a little bit, you know, like I was going to say, if Mum ran out of milk, you know, she could knock next door and lend a bottle of milk off the neighbours. And the neighbours would know Mum would give that bottle of milk back when she had the opportunity and chance. And it was sort of like it was that tight community that I was very, very, very fortunate to be brought up into.
It's amazing as you're talking there to compare that world to the affluence of the Premier League world that you found yourself in. And to compare the two, those formative years, you know, at times going short and your mum maybe knocking next door and vice versa. How do you think that shaped your attitude to money when suddenly it was all around you? Were you always kind of saving for a rainy day, or were you, you know, easy come, easy go? How do you think that shaped you?
Yeah, I've never been in debt in the bank. I've never, you know, again, it's just the basic, I think, principles that you were brought up with as a young boy and in a family. You know, we were always taught to respect people who respected you. And we were always taught to, you know, when I got married, you know, the one thing, you know, my father said is that, you know, you make sure that there's enough food on the table. You know, there's enough water and soap that you can wash yourself with and keep yourself clean and make sure you pay your bills. Mm. And that was, you know, that just basic things that people forget now, Joe, or people don't even talk about anymore. You know, the world's moved on, you know, society's moved on. But having said that, Joe, like I said, if you give me what I've got today and say, would you change that now for your upbringing? I wouldn't at all. Yeah. You know, I've got friends there that I've known from primary school who are still there, or still communicate and talk to and keep in touch with. And, you know, it's, it was a wonderful area to be brought up into.
So you weren't driving into the Stoke training ground in a Ferrari, is what I'm getting at.
Well, it's funny actually, because, you know, I was talking to Deb the other day. You know, I married my wife, and I think her car was the first car that actually came down our road. My dad had a push bike. We never had a car.
Right.
So, you know, if we travelled on foot, or we caught buses. And that was right through all my life. My father did never, ever, ever have a car.
Mm. It strikes me with your playing career, you were unlikely to get offered a Premier League job. You were going to have to take a team up to get to the big time. And you did that with Stoke and did it in style, and I think scored 80 goals in the Championship on the way up. And at that stage, Stoke had been 23 years away from the top division, maybe crowds of 10,000-11,000 when you first took over. And we're talking about, you know, a career here where, as I mentioned, Premier League mainstays, FA Cup final, Europa League. So it went incredibly well. I know I read you phoned Steve Coppell, who'd obviously had his experience at Reading, and Alex Ferguson on promotion. And Ferguson had a good bit of advice. I think he said, if anyone in the top six compliments you, you're doing something wrong. You're not going to win many games away from home. You need to make the Britannia a miserable place to go to. That turned out to be pretty damn good advice. You obviously bought into that a little bit.
He turned out not to be a bad manager, did he?
Yeah.
So, he knew what he was talking about, Joe. And when you speak, you know, I've got great respect for Steve as well, Steve Coppell.
Mm.
You know, Steve had and was a very, very basic person in lots of respects, an intelligent man. But, you know, he was a good man as well. And, you know, he told me about the fact that you would lose, you know, four or five games on the bounce, which you're not used to, what your players are not used to, having come up from the Championship and winning the or being promoted out of the Championship. They got used to winning. And he said, you know, you have to get used to losing, and you have to manage yourself through that period because the players need as much help as they possibly can. And what they don't need a manager with his face around his backside all the time, walking around the place. You've got to manage yourself, and you've got to be positive with them. Yeah, although it'll hurt you, you have to be positive and look positive to everybody around you, because you're the one really, you know, with a flag. You're leading the way. You're leading the charge. And, you know, again, you know, those little bits of advice that you pick up along the way, you know, if you're intelligent enough to take things on board, you know, to wash away all the nonsense and take the important things on board, then, yeah, I think you grasp it pretty soon, and it happens. And it happened exactly the way the two lads said it would.
Mm.
And luckily, you know, I was clever enough to take notice of the two of them.
Yeah, you sure did, Tony. So things like narrowing the pitch, letting the grass grow. I think Arsene Wenger might have written a complaint to the FA about the length the length of the grass at the Britannia. Disgrace. Geez, you know, even I remember we do commentaries, Premier League commentaries here in the station. And I remember you guys came up and like, we had to get like thicker pop shields because the wind at the bloody Britannia, I mean, it was like into the microphone the whole time. So even for us, it wasn't that pleasant to go to at times. And it just worked. The crowd bought into it. So all these kind of things, you were like the great disruptors, and you embraced it. It seems as a team, we're not making it easy for this crowd coming. We're not making it easy for Arsenal.
Well, I did, you know, the bottom line is, Joe, we'd go to play Arsenal away from home. The pitch would be the biggest pitch in the league. it'd have the shortest grass. Mm. They'd water the pitch before the game. And why did they do that? Because it suited them, because they had the best players in the league. Mm. So why shouldn't we do exactly the same at our place to have an advantage that suits us? Well, you know, the problem you've got is that, the perception always falls on one side. Mm. But really and truthfully, we were just doing what they were doing. They were keeping it and making it as comfortable as they possibly could for the players they had. Mm. And, you've got to remember, one of their players most probably cost, as much as all our players put together, three of their players' wages would have paid for our whole salary, including the kids and the people in the canteen and around the training ground and everything else. Mm. So, you're competing. You're not really competing at the same level. And you've got to get results. And as I've said, the basis that I've always worked on, and, sometimes it upsets people, and, hey, who doesn't upset people at times, is the fact that I would try and get the results any which way, within the rules, for my football club. Mm.
And did you ever get a sense that you were getting under the skin of the big boys?
Oh, Arsenal, yeah, definitely. I think, I bump into support Arsenal supporters now, and they'll always say, "Tone, we just hated going to the Britannia, just hated it." But it was, I think, Joe, the other thing is as well, and again, we go perception. We had that first and second year, where we were very, very direct in lots of ways. Rory broke the game up for us with the throw-ins. Mm. But we had some good players, and we got better every year, Joe. Mm. And you don't go to the last stages of Europe. You don't go to a cup final. You don't finish comfortably every year in the Premiership if you've got a bunch of players who can't play. And, when you look at Pennant, you look at Etherington, Crouchy, John Walters, people of that ilk.
Yes.
Good forward players, players who were, who played for their countries, represented their countries and done exceptionally well for their countries. We had a very, very, very solid backbone to the team. But we also had some good players, some very, very good players.
Yeah, no doubt. A quote from Luis Felipe Scolari: "I have never seen anything like this in my life." Now, he's seen a fair few things in his life. So what Luis Felipe Scolari was talking about, and you mentioned him there, Rory Delap's throw-ins. So look, on this side of the pond, we took a certain joy in watching, Walters and Glenn Whelan, and absolutely,
yes,
Rory Delap, yeah, doing his thing. I'm right to say you signed him without even knowing this guy could throw a ball like that.
Well, no, I don't think anybody did. I spoke to Harry. Harry had him at Southampton, and Harry said, "Tone, if I knew he could throw a ball like that, I'd never sold him." They were having a competition one day on the training ground. I think it was pre-season. And they were trying to throw the ball. I think they were having, most probably knowing the lads at that time, we had a great group of players there. Yeah. They're most probably having a little competition who could throw it, further than near post or whatever. And he picked the ball up and threw it. And I didn't see the first one. And David Kemp, who's my assistant, came over to me and just said, "Tone, have you seen how Rory throws this ball?" And I've gone now, and I've walked over to him, and I can remember they're at the top end of the training ground. And Rory's just—he's not just throwing it; he's pinging it in there, and it's as flat as a pancake. It was just—I just pulled him. I said, "Rory, where have you been hiding that all your life?" And from that moment onwards, we sat down. He said, "Yeah, it'd be a great, great opportunity, great chance to get balls into the box, great opportunity to put teams under pressure." And that's what we did. And, it's, poor old Rory's played over 500 games in the top flight, I think. He'll just be remembered for that long throw. You play 500 games, you're a good player.
Yeah.
You're not just one dimensional. And like I say, Rory will always be remembered for just that, long throw.
There was one season where a quarter of your 38 goals came from throw-ins. So, I mean, there was obviously great intelligence, and they were choreographed, and you worked in them as well. You knew it was getting under people's skin when
We didn't just throw the ball in.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't just throw the ball in. You know, off set plays, a lot of set plays, we would be very, very diligent in the work that we did. I think if you speak to the players now, they'd all moan and groan about the amount of time that they spent on doing set plays and working on set plays. Because in the early, like I say, the early years in the Premiership, we needed to find ways. We weren't gifted enough to open the top teams up, even at home. So we had to find ways to score goals.
Yeah,
and like I say, set plays was one of the big things.
I was just going to say there, you knew it was working when there was the famous moment where Boaz Mayhill of Hull scrambled to stop the ball going out for a throw so we could kick it out for a corner. That's when you knew teams.
Well, I'll talk about Harry. Harry said to me, you know, they'd turn up with Tottenham. And Harry said, I used to say to the lads, you know, kick it out for a corner. So kick it out for a throw-in. So, you know, it was a great, great weapon. And Rory was one of the bedrock people who we built the football club around. You know, not just a good player and a good player with that wonderful long throw, but what a lovely lad as well in character. He's just a fabulous, fabulous boy.
Yeah. Can I ask you about Glenn Whelan? And tell me if I'm right or wrong here. My sense of Whelan's career was that quite often Stoke would go and sign a midfielder in the summer in the anticipation of that midfielder maybe taking Glenn Whelan's place or certainly playing more. And one after one, Whelan kept seeing them off. Is that a fair... Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I've got the greatest respect for Glenn. Every challenge you put in front of him, he would step up again. And we brought some good midfield players in. And I don't know, through pre-season, at the beginning of the season, Glenn would just step up. And irrespective of what I'd spent on that midfield player, I always pick what I think are the best players for the team. And Glenn would always prove to be the best player for that position, what we wanted. And like I say, as an individual and as a person, he can be a bit spiky at times with his teammates and with everybody else. You know, I have as a person and as a manager, having worked with players, the fella's got the greatest respect for me for, you know, just proving every not a great favourite with the supporters, not a great favourite with the people, all the public, but his teammates loved to play with Glenn because he did all the donkey work, Joe. And he was tidy enough on the ball; he'd keep the ball. And a very, very intelligent player as well.
Right. Yeah. No, I think we underrated him here as well in Ireland for a long time. I heard a story you told as well. I guess this kind of, you know, if he's kind of a cultural architect in some ways or sets a tone, you were saying there was a young player, I don't know who it was, and Glenn Whelan passed the ball to him, wasn't the best pass. And, you know, in front of the crowd, young player does that thing you should never do, which is, you know, shakes the head or throws the arm up. Glenn let him know pretty quickly that's not how Stoke was going to operate.
Well, it was a training session, actually, and it was Brett Shea, who played for America, and we'd signed Brett. And unfortunately, he'd come over. You know, he'd long, flowing blonde hair. But he was a nice lad, Brett. I think, you know, you look at him initially and you think he's a bit of a Charlie, but he was a nice lad. And Glenn hits this crossfield pass that went out to play, and Brett just stuck his hand up. I turned around to... We were doing 11 of the 11. I was coaching something. By the time I turned back, Glenn had... Let's just say shook him up a bit. You know, Brett never, ever got involved in any of that nonsense from that point. But, Joe, that was the club. That was the team. The club was, as I've said, I was brought up in a community, in a family, very, very family-orientated community where everybody helped everybody else and everybody was as important as everybody else. And I've always tried to build football clubs like that. And, you know, if you spend enough time there, you know, the 4 years I had at Priestville, that team that I left was absolutely fantastic. Wonderful players. And they all worked so hard for one another and gave everything for one another. Mm. You know, you talk about side by side. They were. And at Stoke, again, over that period of time, everybody was side by side. You know, if one person was in trouble, you know, there'd be five or six looking after him. There wouldn't be one standing up for him. There'd be five or six looking after him, and they would, you know, they would, they proved that that community spirit was transformed into a football club, and into an area, because we had unbelievable support. The Britannia Stadium was, you know, those first 3 years, 4 years, it just rocking, absolutely rocking. Yeah, everybody bought into what we were trying to do.
Did you feel the expectations of the crowd change then? Because the perception would be, I mean, you kept delivering in a sense. I mean, Premier League stability and obviously FA Cup final bonus thrown in, Europa League thrown in. Could you feel that, you know, it's, I asked that because you say the first three, four years there, that suggests maybe there was a bit of a change. Wasn't quite bouncing. Was there more of a crossing our arms and what's next for us kind of thing?
I think again, we talk about society. I think society has moved on, Joe. And you know, in the times that we could walk up to a telly and turn it on and then walk up to the telly to turn the station over have gone. You've got, you know, digital things that just change. And I think there's been a sea change in management in this country as well. I think the time, you know, the times that people say, well, managers now can have a set time and given a set period to build a football club. Unless you're very, very fortunate. I mean, very, very fortunate. Unless you're winning games. And even when you do win games and you overachieve and you overachieve, you know, the supporters still want more. Mm. The public still want more. People still want more. And I understand that completely. And I understand the fact that there'll always be people out there. Never mind what you give them, They'll always want that little bit more, Joe. And supporters are no different. And like I say, the reaction of the first couple of years at Britannia, I can remember the first win against Villa. The noise. I think it was a long throw. Mama scored on the back post. Martin O'Neill was manager at Villa, I think, at the time, and they had a really good team. I'm not sure if they finished close to being in the top four that year.
The whole
stadium, Joe, just erupted. And it went on. You know, we played Man City with 10 men. James Beattie scored a goal just before half time, and I can remember coming in afterwards and people saying, well, it's an extraordinary result to win 1-0 against Man City, you know, with just 10 men. And I said, no, 10 men, there's 30,000 Stoke supporters out there. Against, you know, I felt sorry for the Man City players. And they did. They cheered every pass, every tackle, every challenge. Every time Man City had a shot, it was blocked or whatever. You know, the whole place went up. It wasn't just one area or one bit. We'd really built up, Joe, an unbelievable atmosphere there. And a togetherness that was, very, very unique. Very unique.
We're chatting here with Tony Pulis. If you're just tuning in, this is our football special with thanks to Paddy Power for information on responsible gambling. Visit gamblingcare.ie. A few messages coming in. Jim says, lads, could Messi have done it on a cold, windy night at Stoke? That's the big question. Well, indeed. I mean, that was the ultimate compliment. I think Messi would have been okay at Stoke all the same, Tony.
Oh, yeah. Messi.
I think he'd have managed.
You could play Messi over the park tomorrow. And it could be playing on stones, a stony pitch. The fella's a genius, absolute genius. Yeah, blimey. If he'd have turned up at Stoke, even with the wind, even with the rain and it being midwinter, nah. He would have been what he is, one of the greatest players we've ever seen.
Did you depart then Stoke on good terms, bad terms? I know you're still very, very fond of Peter Coates. How did that finish?
It was the right time. Okay. It was done properly. I met Peter and John in the offices at Bet365, and it was amicable. Okay. And to this day, you know, I still keep in touch with them. They're wonderful people. You know, that Peter was a fabulous chairman to work under. He was brilliant for me, Joe, because I can if I feel as though things have turned and people are doing stuff that they shouldn't be doing, then I do get very, very irate and uptight. And you know, most managers that you speak to, irrespective of who they are, can be a little bit insecure at times. But Peter was brilliant. Peter treated me and managed me like no other person I've ever had above me. He knew my strengths, he knew my weaknesses, and it was a great time, great period, and I have the utmost respect for him.
Because I saw you say you are determined to the point at times of obsessive, where you could be irritable, is what you said, to put it nicely. And you said Peter managed you very well in that way. So you took some managing from his end. Were you just always looking around and unhappy with this and want things perfect? Or what did Peter do to calm you down at times?
I always wanted to make sure. We had taken him into the Premier League. It wasn't just me. It was the football club and the people involved, the players, coaching staff. Peter, the directors, the coach family who have been fabulous support, have been fabulous support to Stoke City and to the community there. And I felt a personal responsibility to keep him there. I felt the personal responsibility to try and improve it year after year after year. So if I seen things going on that I didn't think was right, or people were becoming sloppy, or people were doing stuff, people were perceived to be doing stuff that they weren't really doing, then I'd be very forthright in my views and my opinions. And I think what Peter was great at, Peter could read me. And we'd go out, he'd take me out for dinner on a Thursday night, usually on a Thursday night with Deirdre, Malcolm his driver, and we'd sit there and, after a couple of glasses of wine, he'd talk about, he'd bring it up, but he'd always bring it up when he had me. We'd talk history, which is a topic that I really, really enjoy. And Peter's a well-read person. And we'd talk about something that some event or some, some happening with World War One, Two, or the Napoleonic Wars or whatever. We'd go into something. He'd get me nice and comfortable, nice and relaxed. I'd have a couple of glasses of wine. Mm. And then he'd say, listen, on that point, I think you're a little bit out of order there. Or listen, I'll take your point. And I've spoken to people. We'll make sure that doesn't happen again. So he was fabulous. He managed me and the way he handled me. And I think Peter had had great experience. He'd worked with Lou McCary, Joe Jordan. I know he had Chris Kamara. So he'd had he'd had some sort of strong characters there as well before. He had Gary there. Gary Megson was there as well. So, he had some strong characters and some strong people. So we'd had the experience of working with these people. And, He could work me, Joe. He could definitely work me.
And have you mellowed?
Yeah, I think I've mellowed over a period of time. I also think that I've changed over a time as well. I think that first setting with me at Priestfield, and that would have gone on well into maybe even when we got into got promoted out of the Championship. But as time changed, and with the quality of players that you work with and the way life has turned around, and the health and safety and all this stuff now, that you have to be careful what you say and what you do. You understand and you recognize, you become more educated as you go along, understand that it's a different world now to what we lived in 20, 30 years ago when I started. Well, longer than that, Joe.
So tactically things are very interesting right now. You didn't happen to watch Monday Night Football this week, did you, where Jamie Carragher was doing a piece on how Tuchel's centre-backs are roving up into midfield and pressing? Did you catch that by any chance?
I've seen people fall over backwards with people playing with no centre-forwards. Pep has played with no centre forwards. He's played this and he's done that. In 1975, 76, something like that, I went to a coaching seminar at Bath University, and Malcolm Allison took Bristol Rovers under 18s as one team, and Bristol City's under 18s as another team, and he put a session on exactly the same with no centre forwards.
Right.
And the way he did that, this is Malcolm Allison, this is in the 70s, and the way he did it is exactly the way that the lads are doing it today. And it was just, extraordinary. I'm looking at, you can imagine, in 76, where, England, we were still playing 4-4-2 or whatever, get the ball forward, back it up, and this. The way he did it was just absolutely unbelievable. It was frightening. I've watched, learned and listened to a lot of great coaches in my time. I think the coaches that we've got in now, Most probably the, you know, we've had the best coaches in the world in England, apart from maybe the lad who was at Juventus, won all those titles. And the lad at Atletico Madrid, they're most probably the two biggest names that we've missed out on. They've been, I think that they've certainly brought something different to the game in England.
Yes.
They've certainly improved it. They've brought the levels up. I think they've brought the levels up in lots of ways. But I also think there's some wonderful coaches in England, and there's coaches who do and can do jobs at these lads that we're talking about. I have no, you know, I have great respect for Pep. You know, he'd become a very good friend over a period of times, but I don't think Pep could do what Deutsch has done at Burnley. I don't think Tuchel can do what Deutsch has done at Burnley. I don't think there's many these coaches are used to working with the top players, with the best players, and you know what Sean has done at Burnley and other managers in respect now who are managing below the sandline who get results. Chris Wilder at Sheffield United last year. Obviously, it's not happened this year for him, but last year, you know, the results that these lads get, and they're working below the sandline. It takes a lot of coaching, a lot of hard work, and a lot of preparation to get results. What you're doing, Joe, you are playing against teams every week who've got better players than you, so-called, on paper. The budgets are bigger. They've got better facilities. They've got better organisation behind the scenes, better recruitment. They spend an absolute fortune on what they do. And you're behind them. But every Saturday, you've got to turn up and try and get results and try and win football matches. And the people who do it at the smaller clubs on a regular basis, you know, they should be admired more in this country than what they are.
Yeah, I take the point. The reason I asked you about the Tuchel centre-halves the other night is it just jumped out to me, and I knew I'd be talking to you, and I may have this wrong, so I'm kind of curious to get your sense of tactics and how they've changed. I would have had Stoke maybe as a more compact team, that bit deeper. You certainly would have seen centre-halves covering each other and not roving off, following men.
Yeah.
So if you were back in the Premier League anytime soon, would your approach change then, or would it be very much a Stoke approach?
If I was managing Chelsea, if I was managing Man City, of course it'd change.
Well, even kind of a lower...
That's the point.
Yeah, no,
the
no.
Point
but
I
even
was making right at the beginning.
Even a lower table team. Because I don't see, for instance, the great disruptor anymore. Like Big Sam and West Brom have gone down, and I would have had you down as a disruptor, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way.
Yes.
But you watch teams now, right down even to League One, and you've got like the centre half splitting and taking the ball from the keeper. You know, it's all more homogenised. So would you almost have to go that way, or could you still disrupt almost in the way you did with Stoke?
I played with Johnny Evans at West Bromwich Albion.
Yeah,
and you know, Johnny was a great footballer, great on the ball. You'd let Johnny have the ball anyway on the pitch. You know, Johnny could play in midfield, he could play centre half, play fullback, he could play centre forward. I think so. If you've got players like that, Joe, who are comfortable with the ball and not going to cost you, then yeah, you know, why not? But if you haven't, if you've got stoppers, if you've got Shawcross and Huth and people who were, you know, their strengths are defending, not dealing with the football, especially under pressure, then you wouldn't put him in. I wouldn't put him in that position.
Yeah,
Joe.
It's common sense.
It's common sense. I went from Stoke, where we had a Crouch or a Kenwyn Jones or whatever, so we had a target man we'd play off. So we'd always be looking to play off them and get setups to go wide. And then I went to Palace with Bolasie and Punch and wide and Cameron Jerome up front, who was a runner. So you got three runners. It was completely, we had to play completely different at Palace than what we did at Stoke. And then when I went to West Brom, we had midfield players as our best wide players. So instead of playing, and we had a lad called Bobby Brown, who they'd signed from abroad somewhere. You know, what's his name? Saido Berrino. So Saido, you know, Saido was a young lad, 20 years of age, playing as a 10. So we completely played different there. We played the wide players inside the pitch. And we played Saido and Brownie a little bit deeper. So we'd get smaller passes. We had good footballers, you know, Brunty, Morrison, people like that. Really, really good footballers. So you could play through the pitch to get where you eventually want to get. And that's in dangerous areas where you can cross balls to get people scoring off crosses, or, you know, people shooting from around the area or just inside the area. So if you have a look, you know, if you're sensible enough and you understand your tactics in football, you have a look at the teams that that managers take over. And then, you know, like I say, and the clubs I'm talking about, I'm going into football clubs at Palace and West Brom, where you have to get results almost immediately. You've got no time whatsoever, you know, to say, well, I'll give it 10 games or whatever and then hopefully just change it next season. You have to do what you've got to do with the players you've got.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no way I could have played the way Stoke played with Bobby Brown up front and Saido. Saido couldn't head, you know, a bus queue, never mind the blinking football. So, you know, you just wouldn't.
You wouldn't it, do
it. Wouldn't,
yeah.
It wouldn't have. Yeah, it was completely different, Joe. And that's where, you know, the all that coaching over the years, all that work that I've seen other people do and what you can do, I think, with different individuals is based on their ability.
Yes, well, that makes sense. I was talking to...
I get a little bit frustrated at times that, you know, and I'm talking about even the lad at Southampton who's done a good job there at times, has done a wonderful job there. You know, sometimes he gets a little bit of stick, but again, you know, Southampton are not one of the bigger teams. He is a manager that's come in from abroad. You know, the lad at Barnsley, you know, who's come in at Barnsley and played a way that suits his players. It's not, you know, it's the most direct I've seen since Wimbledon. But he's done they're in the playoffs and he's getting some praise, which he deserves. But he certainly ain't playing out from the back.
No, true.
Because he hasn't got the players to do it.
I was talking to a former player of yours and he was singing your praises and I was saying any kind of memories. And he said two things. He said, brilliant man manager. Brilliant man manager as in, you know, would be in the canteen and sitting with the 16th, 17th, 18th men, keeping their morale up, including them. And then he also said, ask him about pre-season. And he had a picture of a very pained expression. So Drill Sergeant Pulis obviously was no fun pre-season. So they were the two.
Yeah, no, pre-season was always, I'd take him to Austria and... yeah, we'd have a bit of fun for 10 days. But they all bought into it. You look at it on paper, you look and when you get there, you tell the players what you're going to do and they're all looking at you through, thinking, what's this man doing? But, you know, everybody who's done, you know, I spoke to an ex-player of mine the other week. He's got it's amazing. His son is just breaking into professional football and he wanted a little bit of advice for his son. And we got talking about stuff and one of the things he brought up was the pre-season and just said it's unbelievable. It's just, you know, at the time, Gaffer, it was, you know, it's just so hard. But then when you look back, it was just brilliant. The togetherness that it brought a group and how fit we were. I've never been fitter in my life. So, you know, it was, Joe, it's tough, but it's organised, well planned out. And it's done with a purpose. And that was the big thing. You know, people say, oh, he shouldn't be running up hills. You know, I've never seen anybody, our hills were really steep. We've never had a pulled muscle running up a hill. We never let them run down the hills. We always got golf carts. They jump in a golf cart, they come down the hills. So they wouldn't pull any muscles coming down the hills or they wouldn't do any damage coming down. And that, you know, we do strength and conditioning in the afternoon. In a massive gymnasium, we'd play a bit of head tennis and this, that and the other, and in the evenings we'd be on the grass. So you'd have three sessions a day for 10 days and at altitude. And it really helped. And then we'd go to America and I'd work in very, very warm, humid conditions for then, again, another 10 days. Bring them back, we'd play a few games, we'd start the season. So it was all planned out for a reason, and my big thing for pre-season is to get the players through fit and ready to go. Not worry about results. I never worried about results in pre-season. I just worried about their fitness, getting them through fit. No injuries, no problems. If we start with 25, let's finish with 25 and make sure they're fit.
Yeah. I do want to ask you about the history because I know I did read in advance that you like that. There's a load of people texting in saying they're really enjoying hearing from you. Hope to see you back in the game again very soon. And there's a bunch of them, and I know there's no point asking you this because I've watched other interviews you've done. There's a bunch of them saying, ask him about the James Beattie incident in the dressing room. Because that image, once you hear about that story, I think it's hard to forget for people.
No, I think what happens in the dressing room happens in the dressing room. And, you know, James, as I've said before, you know, James, I can't remember him, but what did he get, 12 goals from Christmas on for us? Mm. Or, you know, he was, him and Matty Etherington, that second year, we signed James and Matty. Those two kept us up without a question of a doubt. And I'm a great team man. Mm. But those two individuals, Etherington was just absolutely fantastic on the left-hand side for us. Real quality, real pace. Matty was a top player.
He was always your favourite. You played favourites with him.
Yeah. He was
never got given out
to.
He
was my boy, really. He was my boy. He had tremendous talent. He had his issues off the pitch, and I think that's most probably why I warmed to him so much as well. Mm. But he was, you know, like I say, as a player, I can remember him doing stuff, you know, just extraordinary stuff, you know, outstanding ability. And James came, and I've got to be honest, Joe, you know, he, every time we got a cross into the box, James seemed to score. If he wasn't scoring, he looked as though he was going to score. So, you know, for all, you know, that one incident, you know, Beattie played a big part at Stoke.
Yeah, and
that,
you know,
second year.
You know, so that one incident, and look, it's the fracas in the dressing room, and people find it hilarious because you're both in the nip effectively, because it's showers and these things are funny to us on the outside, but they're day to day in football. On a more serious note, next day or a couple of days after that, does something like that linger, or do you just kind of put that behind you straight away? Is something like that a big deal?
Well, I think there's different. I think there's different instances or happenings. Let's put it this way: that you respond differently with. I think there's you know, stuff that goes on that you can wash away. There's other stuff that you feel as though, you know, that might come back and bite you. It might come back and bite the club. Mm. Might come back and bite the players. It might affect the dressing room. If anything I ever thought would affect the dressing room, in respect of, you know, them being the most important people, then I would deal with it. If I felt that it was something, you know, that we could get over and that we could move on, then there was never a problem with me. I'd always put the club. I don't think I've ever been in a position where I haven't done anything where I think, you know, the club got to come first, and my players have got to come first, and the team's got to come first. And I've been one of those people, Joe, that if I don't think things are being done properly, whether it's a chairman or whether it's a player, whether it's a coach working for me or whatever, then you know, I won't have it, Joe. I just don't have it. Right. It's just not part of me.
Yeah. On the history thing, you mentioned you're a fan of history and you enjoy your reading. So, I mean, you would have left school then at 15 and embarked on this journey. Yeah. Would you like to have gone to university? Is that a regret? You're obviously, you know, if you're drawn to reading history and following history, you've got a brain.
No, Joe. You know, I've been the luckiest man alive. You know, I've come from a very, very, you know, big family. My dad was a steelworker. Mum never went to work. She was in the kitchen all the time looking after the children. And I've come out and had the life I've had. Mm. I've been the luckiest person alive. You know, there's nobody, you know, you take some flack in this job, you take some stick in this job, and people criticize you and people have a go and say this and that. You know, I've been the luckiest person alive. Mm. You know, I've got you know, great experiences as a player, as a coach, as a manager, you know, things that I could never have dreamed of. You know, I've done loads of stuff as well for charity. You know, we've walked Kilimanjaro. I've cycled from John O'Groats to Land's End. We've rode from Tower Bridge to the Eiffel Tower. I've cycled from Paris to Le Havre, rode across the Channel, then walked from Brighton to London. You know, I've done so many things in my life, Joe, that I look back on, and you know, there's stories behind all of it. All the clubs I've been at, what is it, 10, 11 clubs I've been at, There's stories out of every club. You know, the Sheffield Wednesday one didn't last long. I've spoke to a friend there today, and you know, there was lovely. They were, in the short period I was there, there's still lovely people I met. There's still, you know, there's still memories there for me, and good memories. So, you know, it's, I've just been so fortunate.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I
definitely,
I've won the lottery.
I know you have. I definitely wouldn't ask you, would you swap it for university? But obviously there was a thirst for knowledge there or something there. So when did all that start and why history, do you think?
I always looked at, I was fascinated with leaders who had come from nowhere.
Right.
You know, Napoleon, obviously born in Corsica, although it was a rich family in Corsica. You know, a little boy then sent to France, and how did he become one of the, you know, the one of the greatest generals in European history? You know, whichever way you look at it, whether it's good or bad, or, you know, you might be a negative on Napoleon, you might be a positive with him, but how did he get to that point? You know, and different people like that, people who have worked their way through. You know, Churchill was part of the establishment. And he was in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. And he was in and out and in and out because of the establishment. And he was a great wartime leader. He was a man for our time then. And that was he was a great orator and this, that and the other. But, you know, he didn't float my boat because he was part of the establishment. It's people who have had to work their way up, Joe, and people who have been successful from coming from nowhere. Right. You know, they're the people that interest me.
Yeah, I mean, I you don't have to be Freud, Tony, to probably see where you can relate to them, I suppose. Is that the interest?
I suppose, yeah. And the other thing that I like reading about is their journeys as well. You know, what, you know, was it just from, you know, they went from the bottom to the top straight away, or did they, you know, why did they then fall? You know, why did they stumble? You know, if they came back, what brought them back? And, you know, that, yeah, it's just, I just like it. And, you know, like I say, World War One history, that, you know, the turn where really, you know, the first time that really heavy equipment really determined battles. And before that, I think, you know, Napoleonic years, how many, you know, soldiers were killed man to man fighting, Joe? Mm. You know, it's just extraordinary that these people would follow a leader.
Isn't it a shocking waste of all that life over, you know, decisions made at the top with such little regard?
Joe, what amazes me as well is the way they lived. You know, I've read a book, The Dorset Soldier. It's out there somewhere,
right.
About a lad who enrolls and I think he eventually ends up in one of Wellington's regiments. But the way they lived, Joe, you know, it's just extraordinary. You know, they were so tough,
yeah,
so resilient. They're just a different breed to us. You know, marching for months and then fighting. You know, it's just extraordinary.
Yes.
That the amount of, you know, pain that they must have gone through, but most probably never even thought about it, Joe. It's just a different world, and something that. You know, I sometimes look back on and think, oh, you look at what we've got now.
Oh, listen,
you look at what those people went through.
I don't know how political you were, but during, and I could be off here, but my guess would be during the 80s and Thatcher's time that it wouldn't have been great for Newport or some of the industries that you came from. Yeah. So what was that like as you're kind of making your way in football? It can't have been a great time for Newport. Do you have memories of that, or did you feel politically motivated at any stage?
Well, I think Wales is still the only country in the UK has voted in a Labour government again. It's inbred in you, really. Mm. I've been very disappointed with Labour. I've been very, very disappointed with the way it's been run over the past, 10, 12 years. But, you know, you're brought up in that environment. You're brought up, you know, to Thatcher was despised in South Wales.
Mm.
And I mean despised for what she did. You know, she broke up communities, and I don't think she'll ever be forgiven there.
And was that a horrific time for your wider family?
I think it was a horrific time for people who lived, especially up the valleys, Joe. There was whole communities that were just destroyed without any thought. That was the worst thing, you know, shutting down. She had a point I'm not saying Scargill and the unions did any good in you know the way they projected their ideas, and there should have been a middle ground found, but then you had one very very stubborn woman who I believe just wanted to prove to everybody that you know no one was bigger than her and the power that she had. But it was back. It was I look back and I think they were really really poor times. You know you live through them and you get on with life, Joe. That's what you do. But it's left a real stain. Like I say, especially up the valleys. You know, you go up there and see the community still haven't recovered today from what was taken away from them.
And will Wales ever go for independence? Is that coming?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it's a good thing, a bad thing. You know, I think I'd rather be us all be together, I suppose, in if you want my view. I'd rather, we're stronger together. And it's wonderful, you know, when you see the British Lions travel away and you see the support, the with, you know, all the union supporters there, and the spirit that's generated and brought together is just remarkable. And I'd love to keep that, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think? What's your views?
I wouldn't know enough about Wales at all. I think the Scots are heading that way. British and Irish Lions as well, Tony.
British and Irish Lions. Yeah. But if Wales are knocked out of a tournament and you've got Ireland in, I want Ireland to win, or Scotland to win, or England to win. Yeah. You know, that's the way I am.
Yeah.
It's you know, that's I've always been that way. I've always been this country first. And I say this country, I mean the union.
Yes. So the Sheffield Wednesday thing lasted about 10 games and that ended in December. You're still fit, healthy, strong. Are you itching to get back in the game? Are there years ahead, hopefully, of management for you? Are job offers coming? Are job offers not coming? What's the next couple of years looking like?
Well, I've got 7 grandchildren, Joe. I've got 2 in the room next door to me that we've been out playing crazy golf this morning with. I've got, obviously, my son is in America with Miami. We've not been able to go over there for a year now. We've got two grandchildren there that we haven't seen for a year, which is, you know, killing Deb. You know, she's desperate to get over and see him. But we've got 5 very close to us. So that's been a real bonus for me. I've done other stuff as well, Joe, which I've, you know, it's been really good. It's taken my mind off. I think you've got to keep yourself, if you're occupied and you're doing stuff and you're engaged with other stuff, then, you know, that keeps me going. If I was sat here twiddling my thumbs, I'd be an absolute nightmare. You know, really? I'm still up 6 o'clock in the morning. I still do my work in the gym. I've got a lovely garden, Joe. I'm getting better at gardening than I've ever been before. And, you know, I'm picking up little things here, what to do, what not to do. I've cleared away some stuff and got this little fountain going in the back of the garden, which we hadn't seen for a few years. So little things like that, Joe, it's been nice. It's been refreshing.
And if the phone rings, are you looking at the phone hoping it rings?
Joe, you can never say never in football. But I have to say, I have enjoyed this break. This has been a good break.
Right. So maybe let's enjoy it a bit longer and not rush back type thing.
Well, we'll see. You know what football's like, Joe.
I do. You'll be back in work in a week, is the thing.
Oh, I have to get past Deb.
listen, it's great to hear about your youth and where you came from and how things went at Stoke, and I'm sure we probably will see you back in a job again. You love it too much, I think, to stay away. But Tony Pulis, it's been really lovely having you on the show. All the best for the future. Thanks so much.
Yeah, cheers, Joe. Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Hyland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Hyland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at Hyland.com.